All right, we all set? Excellent. All right, well, good morning. I call this regular meeting of the Public Service Commission to order. It is 10 o'clock on Wednesday, February 17th. I'm Commissioner Julie Fedorchak. Also present with me are Commissioner Randy Christman and Commissioner Brian Kulk. So we have a quorum. I mean, Brian Crosius, jeez. Oopsie. The power outages have gotten to me.
There's been some disturbances, but we do not need to bring in the Marines yet.
I am so sorry. I don't know where that came from. Now I have to text him and say.
You know, you've got BK 1.0, BK 2.0. Yeah. So it's
I'm just stuck in the past, I guess.
Perfectly understandable.
Stuck in the past. Wow. Okay, Commissioner Brian Crosius, so we have a quorum. My apologies, Brian. All right, just in terms of opening comments, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about what the country has been experiencing and what North Dakota has been experiencing of late with the electric grid challenges and the significant weather and rolling power outages, et cetera. So if I look at some of the early takeaways, we aren't entirely over the hump yet, but I hope with the cold weather sort of relaxing a bit in the upcoming days, things will stabilize and we'll start to come out from this. And hopefully Texas will as well, although they still have a ways to go. Early takeaways. So MISO, SPP, and ERCOT all had different experiences, but different outcomes, I should say, but similar experiences in some regards. And so in North Dakota, our most significant problems in terms of people being curtailed or power being shut off were for customers that are part of the SPP system, and that means that they are cooperative members. Our investor-owned utilities, XL Energy, Otter Tail Power, and MDU, part of the MISO system, and there weren't curtailments here for those. But still, all of these regional transmission organizations had issues and challenges. And I really kind of break them down into five things. First of all, the availability of gas was restricted, and the price of gas was extreme. And so I think this questions the dependence that we're seeing seeing calls for more of on this one fuel source. The contracting prices for it need to be examined, and the supply system needs to be enhanced. And that means we need more pipelines, not less, especially if there's going to be continued reliance on this. And people need to realize that system, I think, is not up to what it needs to be to deliver what people are expecting out of gas right now. Natural gas. Secondly, coordination between the utilities and the all of the utilities, the cooperative utilities and the investor-owned utilities and the regional transmission organizations, both in the moment-to-moment and then in the planning, needs to be improved. I think that there were several of the cooperatives, all of the cooperatives, who had no idea that their customers were going to be shedding or kicked off the system and shut down. That needs to be improved, obviously, as well as coordination on outages. I know there was facilities that were out for maintenance that probably shouldn't have been and could have been available with the predictions that were in place for the weather. And so those sorts of things need to be reviewed. The performance of the renewables in extreme weather situations needs to be carefully examined, and we need to be clear and honest about that and how much we can rely on them for the extreme situations in a pinch. I think they need to be effectively credited by the RTOs so that they know how much is needed to back them up safely. And the fourth thing is the market structures, and this is an area where I think we really are lacking, the final two areas. Market structures to ensure the economic viability of facilities with on-site generation. This specifically means coal and nuclear. Those market structures need to be improved to ensure that these resources are available, especially during this time of transition of the grid to a more renewable system, but also we need to finally triple down on our investment in carbon capture to ensure that long-term coal is viable and available to the electric grid, not only in the U.S., but throughout the world, in the quickest way to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide and improve the reduction of greenhouse gases and address the climate change issue that is the goal of all of these efforts, the stated goal. The quickest way to do that is to develop viable economic carbon capture and storage solutions that can be applied to all of the coal-fired units and natural gas-fired units throughout the world. And we need to be honest about that and clear about it. There's not nearly enough being said about that solution, that part of the solution in this whole big discussion on climate change. So those are my early takeaways. We'll be talking later in discussion, admin discussion, about how we want to communicate our thoughts. Those are mine. I'm sure my colleagues have others, to the RTOs and the utilities as we move forward and try to address some of these issues head on so that we don't repeat what's happened. With that, I'll turn over to my colleague, Commissioner Christman.
Well, you made a lot of the main fundamental points that I would have made otherwise, and I don't disagree with you on any of the big points. Clearly, California wasn't good enough of a wake-up call. I don't know if this will be, if we're paying close attention to Texas, who's to the ERCOT area of Texas, which has been hit much harder than anywhere in SPP or MISO. Maybe that will be. I hope so. But you're right on the main fundamental points. I will say I'm not sure that all of MDU got off scot-free, and I'm not familiar with specific examples, but I do believe that some of their communities out west, they actually get power through agreements with either Basin or WAPA. And so I'm not positive that all their communities escaped without going through some of the reductions yesterday. So I'm going to expand. Other than that, I'm going to expand on a couple of your points a little bit and be more specific to the last couple days in the SPP footprint. And one of the things that I've heard a lot from consumers and distribution co-ops has been, well, you know, WAPA didn't give us enough notice. I guess, first of all, I'm not sure why it's just WAPA, because there's really two primary transmission operators for North Dakota within SPP. And so I'm not sure, did Basin give them more notice but not WAPA? And if so, then why didn't the notice from one suffice for them to know how they were going to handle this or what? But I'm just going to go through some statistics here a little bit as far as the notice. SPP went into what they call conservative operations on February 9th. And that does some things. It allows people to get into longer than just day-ahead commitments. It allows opportunities to exceed the FERC-capped $1,000 a megawatt cap if situations are, I mean, it's very detailed, but it allows some things to happen, and it just lets the transmission operators know that there's potential trouble ahead. On Sunday morning, they elevated to emergency level one, but effective Monday at 5 a.m. So there was almost a 24-hour notice that they would be going into alert level one. And alert level one kind of signals that the balancing authority may not be able to maintain their reserves. So then we got to Monday morning, and at 7:22 went to alert level two. And that directs the members to issue public conservation notices. and alerts them that, you know, we're another step closer because there are only three levels. And again, that was at 7:22 on Monday. At 10:08 on Monday, they went to level three, and which is it directs the members to be prepared to implement controlled interruptions. And then at 12:30, the controlled interruptions started, which amounted to about 1.5% of the overall SPP load. Then that afternoon, that ended. They went back down to, I believe, a level two overnight. And then yesterday morning at 6:15, went into level three again. And the controlled interruptions started, I didn't write down the time, probably the most important one on all these, but sometime later in the morning, I believe 6:46 might be the one that I should have put in there, was when the interruptions started, and this time it was for nearly 7%, which was, you know, that's when we really started feeling it. And so kind of the question is, throughout that time period, starting from February 9th mm-hmm. with the conservative operations to starting early Sunday morning with getting into the emergency alert levels, it's the balancing authority, SPP, that has the responsibility to notify them, we've reached a crunch and things need to curtail, and this is your allotment that you need to curtail. It's up to these transmission operators to have a plan in place. And my understanding of the utility business, that's been something that has existed for generations of the electric industry, that there are plans in place for emergencies. Thus, they know what to do when a tornado wipes out a transmission line or something. So, were the notices out early enough? You can't go too early either, or actually the curtailments would have been much larger because in the immediate time before they started, they actually, they've been getting several thousand megawatts from Canada, which SPP has never gotten before. But Canada helped us out. Once again, foreign country has come in and help us out. But had they started earlier before Canada agreed to do that, then the curtailment would have been larger. So you don't want to be too early either. So my point is here, there needs to be, when things settle down, we get through this the best we can, then there needs to be a good forensic examination like any emergency mm-hmm. situation and see where we failed. And I think, you know, there's potential for improvement all over. Have there been too many tests over the years and not enough situations? This is the first time SPP's ever had a curtail. Mm-hmm. And so were companies still taking it seriously? Maybe not. Mm-hmm. And so maybe these alerts need to be more clear or something. Maybe companies have responsibility for having too much dust on top of their emergency operation plan. I don't know what all it's going to be. But I think it's too early to assign full blame to anyone mm-hmm. at this point, except the fact that our country has become too darn reliant on electric generation that is not dispatchable when you really need it. And this morning, remember, while it's warmed up some here, it's still dreadfully cold in most of the population areas of the SPP footprint. And as of 9:30 this morning, in SPP, they were getting 2.5% of their energy from wind, mm-hmm. and in MISO was getting 4.5%. And so all the talk over the last couple years, when every time there's a peak hit in the middle of the night in October or April, and we hit 70% of the energy coming from wind, and we have a big celebration and everything. Well, now when we need them most, they're at 2.5%. And in the meantime, all those other sales, when we really didn't need the electricity, have caused us to shut down the baseload plants that used to sustain us. It's not our demand for energy that has grown here. We're not using much more energy than we have for years. Mm-hmm. It is the fact that we have pushed our formerly reliable, dispatchable units out of business. And that is the big picture, but we'll have a lot to learn from this. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Christman. Commissioner Crotchis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, on both accounts. So I'm going to take a little different tack because some very important information has already been covered, but I think we have to call this for what it is. This has been a significant failure of the system and those responsible for it. And I don't think there's any way to sugarcoat it. In Texas, a mother and an 8-year-old daughter, I believe she was 8, her 8-year-old daughter died of carbon monoxide poisoning because they were running their car in their garage to try and stay warm. A family of 4, the house burned down because they were burning candles to try and stay warm because of the frigid cold. And I've read headlines, coldest outbreak in 30 years. This has been a polar vortex. You hear terms unprecedented cold. In 1933, the coldest temp ever recorded in Texas was 23 below in 1933, almost 90 years ago. So to think widespread cold and Arctic air would not grip the country at times, these systems are supposed to be designed for weather extremes. They're not designed for average temps. They're designed for weather extremes. And for me, it's very frustrating when you have the number of experts we do in this country, from engineers to physicists to programmers, that a plan wasn't in place to address this type of a weather event. And yes, it was extremely cold. It remains extremely cold, as was mentioned in Texas. My father sent me a photo, and the produce and bread, et cetera, the stores are cleaned out. And homes, I mentioned this yesterday when I was testifying on a bill, homes in Texas aren't equipped for this type of cold, so they take more energy. It's not that they can't stay warm, but they take more energy to keep temps at a reasonable level. But when you have a loss of life, it takes more than political statements, and I know my colleagues would agree with that wholeheartedly. It takes more than political statements. It takes action. And a review has to be conducted in terms of where did the failures occur, from communication to planning, because it was mentioned on February 9th, I believe, Commissioner Christman, you stated, the warning signs were there. And my power went out, I believe, around 7:30, 7:40 yesterday morning. I wasn't notified. I don't believe the co-ops were notified. They didn't know this was going to occur, as far as I know. And you had mentioned MDU had one outage, I believe, in the western part of the state. I believe it was Kildare was the information I received, and that was an accidental shutoff, because it wasn't a part of the plan, so to speak, in terms of the curtailments and the rolling blackout. But nonetheless, a lack of coordination and lack of communication led to some incredible problems. And for me, I just have to think, when my power went off, it was a slight inconvenience for me. It wasn't life-threatening. It wasn't a big deal. Overall, for myself personally, we've got kids going to school at that time in the morning. It's a time of heavy commuting, and traffic lights are out. And that was the time that it was shut down. And again, I don't think it was the co-ops. in terms of the notice they may have received or did not receive, but you know, we'll find out more. But it's frustrating, and frankly, going back to some of my original comments about the loss of life, it's incredibly sad that this happened in what is supposed to be a modern society that should be able to plan for these things. Because you are correct, energy usage has not risen So we will find out. You're going to see a lot of different statements and whatnot issued, and people are going to fire shots across different bows, so to speak, as we go through this process. But we really have to figure out what type of definitive action can be taken so this doesn't happen again. And I'll close with that because I could probably go on for a little while. It's just a frustrating situation. So I hope we can start putting it behind us with the warmer temps in this part of the country. And we know that the southern part will still need increased load to get through this. So that concludes my comments.
Thank you, Commissioner Crosius. Okay, we'll move on to the next item, and that is on the consent agenda. We have a few items and our minutes from our last meeting. I move passage of those items.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, for the regular agenda. My item, I move the commission adopt the order on request for extension in Montana Dakota Utilities Company Thunder Spirit Wind Project siting application case number PU-17-192.
Second.
So last October, MDU filed a request for an extension of time to install light mitigating technology for the Thunder Spirit Wind Farm. An informal hearing was held on this extension request on October 21st. The Thunder Spirit facility is an existing wind farm. It's not a new one. So they there's a part of the Century Code that allows for an extension for economic or feasibility reasons. So that's what they're making this request under. That part of North Dakota Century Code. They would like to allow time for the light intensity dimming solution, which is called LIDS for short, that technology to be approved by the FAA. And in their extension request, they state that the aircraft detection lighting system, the ADLS, which is the only approved lighting system, light mitigating technology by the FAA currently, installing that at Thunder Spirit ranges from about $3 million to $3.3 million, not including the annual maintenance fees. And that compared to the cost to install and maintain LIDS at Thunder Spirit would be approximately $672,000. And there is no annual maintenance fee. And so they are making the case under the economic considerations that they would like to have an extension of time. We've met with the company. We've tried to gather as much as we can about the LIDS technology and its status with the FAA. And based on all that information we've gathered, this order would approve their request for an extension. And it states that the LIDS must be installed at Thunder Spirit at either as soon as FAA's decision to approve it and allow that to happen at Thunder Spirit, or no later than December 31st of 2022, which is 1 year later than the current requirement under law for this technology. And if that is not feasible, they have to have the ADLS system installed no later than December 31st of 2022. So with those two things in order, this technology is pretty promising. I think it has the benefit of being less expensive. It has potentially less, fewer issues with our military installations and with the FAA in general, because it doesn't have anything to do with aircraft and whether aircraft are present in the area. And I think it will be potentially more satisfying for landowners because the technology, the lights will be, near as we're told, pretty dim in the best conditions, so that very few people will notice them. And so it has some really great potential. And so it makes sense to me to allow the technology to develop and see if we can try it and test it at this site, see how it works. And so I'm in favor of this extension and am going to vote to support it. And I would also want to say that I think that it is worthwhile to consider it in this case, but that doesn't mean that I would deem it appropriate in every case for every extension if others are considering it. So each case will be, in my mind, looked at as an individual case on its own. So with that, I'm ready to support this order.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I do, and I especially appreciated the last point you made about not setting a precedent to just start flooding us with applications on these. Because, frankly, you know, I am supportive of the motion based on what's in the order. I agree with everything in that order. I don't agree with every detail in our discussion points here. And there was a time when we were first planning for light mitigation generally, when I became aware of ADLS and how that was supposed to work, as far as I was concerned, that was the only good solution, and I was not even interested in LIDS at that point. You mentioned one of the things that has come up, the military installations. I think it's important that LIDS be explored for that reason. And also the fact that ADLS, to me, has been a disappointment. Is it an improvement? Yes. But it's not having those lights off nearly as much as I hoped that it would when we were planning that. So now I am interested in another potential solution to see how well this would work. So when I look at the discussion items and we mention an extension based on technical considerations or economic feasibility, you know, economic feasibility, are economics important? Yes. In the big picture, is this amount of money, if ADLS would work as well as I thought it was going to work when we were talking about it in the first place, I don't think this is enough. I would still say no, let's just go with ADLS. But because it's not, and because of the potential implications both for a better system and for the military, and I like the let's do one of these and hopefully the FAA approves it and we can get one put in place and see how well it works. And so I'm doing this on the technical side of it, not because of the cost consideration. And so, like, I think was your end point, that I hope this doesn't cause other companies that are in this same time deadline as for the end of this year to just think, oh, well, we just have to say it costs more money, which we know is the case, and they will approve an extension. That's not necessarily going to be the case.
I'm also going to support the motion because I'm willing to see how the new technology plays out and you know, real application, if you know, assuming it gets to that point as they explore this option. And but two very important factors that we have to remember. One, I think I stated it in the past. It is a different approach than what the public may be expecting, where as in the last legislative session, it was this was when it came to the lighting of wind facilities, that the lights would be, the skies would be dark again. So I believe this can get down to as low as 10%, I believe. And I did watch videos tied into this to see what does that really look like. So you have that aspect of it. The other aspect, it is more costly. And ultimately, since this facility is owned by an investor-owned utility that we regulate, those costs will ultimately fall on the ratepayer. So we have to keep that in mind as well.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Thank you, Steve. All right, that concludes my portfolio. Over to you, Commissioner Crisman.
Yeah, quite a few items, but the last few shouldn't take much time because they're carbon copies of each other, just about. It's a different companies involved. So, but the first few need a little more intense explanation. First one, I move the commission issue surface coal mining permit number NACT-1801 to the Coteau Properties Company to permit 5,272.142 acres at the Freedom Mine in Mercer County in Coteau Properties Company, permit NACT-1801 application, PSC case number RC-18-408.
Second.
This permit is a consolidation of five existing Freedom Mine permits, and altogether they total about 5,772 acres. And this is located about 6 miles north of Beulah, and it falls within portions of 11 sections in Mercer County. These permits are contiguous to one another. Coal removal within this total permit area is complete, and any remaining unmined tracks are permitted for surface disturbance only. The portions of the consolidated permit area will be used to support mining activity in other permit areas at the Freedom Mine, so that's why it's not being released. The majority of the disturbed areas within 1801 have been reclaimed. These five consolidated permits currently exist as paper permits. They're from those days, and so they're very voluminous upstairs. And the consolidation into permit NACT-1801 is now provided in electronic format. The Reclamation Division is required to conduct a permit review every 5 years and a midterm permit review in between. So consolidating these five permits into one will significantly reduce the permit review time for our Reclamation Division and the time and resources required for Coteau personnel to update the permits for our reclamation people. Coteau published the permit application notice in the Beulah Beacon and Bismarck Tribune newspapers in November and December of 2019. That's not a mistake. It is 14 months ago. The latest publication date was December 12th of 19. We notified the appropriate agencies, affected landowners of the permit application. No objections or requests for an informal conference were received in the application. Coteau filed the required bond documents for the new permit area, and the Reclamation Division has determined the collateral and self bonds in the amount of $146 million are satisfactory at this time for this permit and the others at the Freedom Mine. The Reclamation Division has completed its review of the permit and recommends that it be approved. When this is approved, hopefully, Coteau will consist of this, and they still have five other permits, so there will be a total of six, but this is consolidating five into one. And by the way, their total permit area is 45,209 acres. But this will be a big improvement, both the fact that it's electronic and that it's consolidated, and a work reduction for our staff as well as Coteau's.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
RC2, I move the commission approve the request of Aurora Wind Project, LLC, to execute the letter of release of the construction phase financial assurance letter of credit and approve the operational phase letter of credit, both filed on December 22nd, 2020, in Aurora Wind Project, LLC, Aurora Wind Project, Williams County, decommissioning plan and cost, case number PU-19-318.
Second.
On February 26th of 2020, Aurora filed the construction phase letter of credit for $19.25 million issued by Bank of America. In our rules, we require that before they begin construction, and it's based on a percentage of their estimated construction costs. on November 18th, we approved the operational letter of credit form to cover their decommissioning costs, and the costs are the full amount of what of the approved decommissioning estimate that we have approved. In this case, that is $13,868,887. That is determined by getting third-party engineers to estimate that cost. So it is $5 or $6 million less than their construction letter of credit. On December 22nd, Aurora filed that operational phase letter of credit issued by U.S. Bank. And so Aurora has requested that we execute this letter of release on their construction letter of credit and return it to Bank of America. That's where they had got the construction one. So it's not only a reduction as per our rules, it's a different bank that's doing this letter of credit. So staff recommends that the commission approve and it also points out that this these letters of credit have undergone a full legal review.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Now we get into some telecom cases, and I'm really excited about the direction these are going, and I'll get into that more. I move the commission adopt the order on eligible telecommunications carrier designation in Beck Communications Cooperative, designated eligible carrier application case number PU-20-458.
Second.
On December 18th, Beck filed an application for designation as an eligible telecom carrier for the purpose of receiving Federal Communication Commission's Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. And the rest of the way, I'll refer to that as RDOF. It's the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund funding in specified census blocks in rural areas of North Dakota. On January 6th, we issued a notice of opportunity for hearing, providing until February 15th for comments and requests. There were no comments or requests for hearing. So the issues to be considered in this matter are, is the applicant qualified? Is the ETC universal service support area, what support area should be designated? And is the designation of this applicant as an ETC in the public interest? So in addition to regular federal universal service support requirements, additional RDOF requirements include that Beck must offer commercially at least one voice and one broadband service at speeds of up to 1 gigabit per second. Beck must build out to 40% of the requisite number of locations in North Dakota within 3 years of authorization, and then that benchmark increases by 20% by the end of the fourth and fifth years of support. And Beck's application states that to the extent applicable, it will meet each of these criteria. I mentioned locations. In this case, they were the successful bidder on almost 340 locations in North Dakota. The amount of this grant would be $2.15 million. Both federal law and state law give this commission the authority to designate a common carrier as an ETC, and based on the evidence in this proceeding, Beck is qualified for designation as an ETC. The FCC has specified the geographic RDOF Phase 1 areas, and I believe it is in the public interest that Beck be designated as an ETC in this RDOF Phase 1 areas as requested. And by the way, I will mention, and this will apply to the next cases too. So RDOF, as I kind of alluded to, it's for areas that don't have broadband available, basically, and there was a reverse bidding held around the nation. The FCC has a certain amount of money for this, and they came up with what they deemed the best set of bidders to spread this around and hopefully get as much bang for the buck as they could. In North Dakota, I think there's about 8 successful bidders in different areas. I'll be addressing, 4 or 5 more of them here as we go. this was the first one, and the first step of it really is to get this ETC status, and so that's where we're at with Beck, and I'll tell you where the other companies are in this process as we go here.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Commissioner Christman, I believe you meant to say the most band for the buck.
Good one.
Any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Next up, I move the commission issue an amended notice of opportunity for hearing in Dactel Communications LLC, designated eligible carrier expansion application, case number PU-21-41.
Second.
So in the case of Beck, we had the notice of opportunity for comments or hearings and have now approved them for ETC. The rest of these, their application was a few weeks later than Beck, so these are just motions to put out the notice for opportunity. These are not approvals at this point. And so on January 21st, Dactel filed an application for designation as an ETC for the purpose of receiving these FCC RDOF funds in some different census blocks in North Dakota. The FCC requires, again, that they be designated by June 7th. That's the case for all of these. They've filed this application. In addition to it, they also filed an application for designation as an ETC for the purpose of receiving federal universal support for low-income customers, the Lifeline-only designation. And they filed that in conjunction with this other ETC, and so we're doing both of these notices here. But that is one thing that distinguishes this Dactel application from all the rest. Do not involve the Lifeline designation. This one does. So again, but it's the same things to be considered. Is the applicant qualified? What support areas should be designated, and is designation in the public interest? And so in this case, those interested are invited to comment in writing. A person's desire in a hearing must file a written request identifying their interest in the proceeding and the reasons for requesting the hearing. That, I'm not going to keep repeating, that'll be the case in the next four. And the comments and requests for hearings must be received by March 29th. If deemed appropriate, like we did in the Beck case, the commission can determine the matter without a formal hearing. I will say, as for the RDOF funds, in the case of Dactel, this is over $500,000, and I believe it's about 66 locations. And Dactel, for those unfamiliar, is kind of the area, I don't know about how far it goes, but kind of the area that surrounds Jamestown, you know, maybe 75-mile radius or something like that. But that's Dactel.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
I'm missing five here. Okay, I found it. I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in MLGC LLC, designated eligible carrier expansion application case number PU-21-50.
Second.
On different date, January 28th, MLG filed an application. Same thing as the last one, except for not that Lifeline part. Same issues to be considered. Same deadline for filing a request for hearing or filing comments, March 29th. And again, if deemed appropriate, we can make the decision without a hearing. This is a big one in that RDOF funding. Well, actually, I'm not sure. I was going to go back and separate these. At one point, I had this and the next two combined. And so I don't have the statistics for each of these three separately, but between MLGC and then Polar, which is next, and Halstead, which is next, the three of them combined are over $9 million and over 1,200 locations.
Wow.
And these are those rural areas that sometimes even have phone trouble, but certainly do not have broadband. And it's a great opportunity. And MLGC, I wasn't neglecting, that is their title. But what that is, it's the headquarters is in Enderland, to give you some perspective where it's at. And it's what was one time the old Moore and Liberty Company, and then Griggs County Tel, and they were combined and became MLGC, but they're headquartered out of Enderland.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in Polar Telecom Incorporated, designated eligible carrier expansion, application case number PU-21-51.
Second.
Polar applied on January 28th. Pretty much everything else just is on track with the last one. This is part of that group that combined are over $9 million. And Polar is headquartered in Park River, so it's, you know, kind of in that northeast area of the state.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
RC7, I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in Halstead Telephone Company, designated eligible carrier expansion, application case number PU-21-55.
Second.
Halstead also applied on January 28th. Everything else is the same as the last couple. Again, March 29th would be the deadlines to apply to us for to request a hearing or to file comments. Halstead is a company, they mostly serve western Minnesota. They do come over. Hillsboro is served by Halstead. And I don't think it's a lot more in North Dakota. But Hillsboro, I think, is their main town in North Dakota. I was going to have those maps, but then it seems like the last couple of days something else came up.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
And last but not least, I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in Reservation Telephone Cooperative, designated eligible carrier expansion, case number PU-21-78.
Second.
Reservation also applied on January 28th. Everything else is the same as the last ones. This is a little over $330,000, about 70 locations. And since this is the last of these, and I neglected to bring the maps, I'm just going to throw out that before coming here, I had the great honor to what is now banned and includes these companies. Was then the NDATC, the North Dakota Association of Telecommunications Cooperatives, and I had the great opportunity to be president of the organization for a while. So if I improperly described the service areas or communities with any of these, I sure apologize. I'm just going by memory here, but I think I got them right. So, because I'm sure I'll hear it if I didn't.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
And that concludes my portfolio, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Commissioner Crosius, you have two items, I believe.
Yes, I have two items. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the commission adopt the order and notice of default in Public Service Commission NC3 LLC, Damage Prevention Enforcement, case number PU-20-96.
Second.
On March 2nd, 2020, the commission received a North Dakota one-call complaint from Walsh Water Users Incorporated alleging a violation by NC3 LLC of North Dakota Century Code Chapter 49-23, the one-call excavation notice system. Commission staff did send a letter to NC3 enclosing the complaint, and that was sent on March 12th, 2020, and requested a response by March 26th. On August 24th, Walsh filed additional details about the March 2nd incident, or I should say the complaint. The complaint actually occurred in 2019. And this has been a process, so you're going to hear a fair number of dates. On August 31st, 2020, Commission Advocacy staff filed a complaint alleging NC3 violated North Dakota Century Code, and the Commission did receive a response from NC3 on September 16th, 2020. On September 23rd, and again, remember the complaint that was filed was by advocacy staff on August 31st. Then on September 23rd, 2020, the Commission found the complaint filed on March 2nd, 2020, states a prima facie case, and service of the complaint was initiated on September 24th, 2020. On September 25th, 2020, a return receipt was signed by NC3's registered agent, as evidenced by the return receipt on file with the commission. And then on January 21st, 2021, advocacy staff filed and served a motion and notice of motion for order of default. So this stems back to an incident that occurred on September 30th, 2019, as I alluded to. NC3 personnel began an excavation while performing a fiber optic line installation in the northeast corner of the intersection of U.S. Highway 81 and 71st Street Northeast in North Dakota. And no, I do not know where that is, other than it's somewhere very close to U.S. Highway 81. There was some damage to the water line, those damages, of course, were caused by the excavation. And what happened, NC3 had moved beyond the ticketed area. And when you move beyond the ticketed area, as soon as you do that, if it hasn't been previously identified, you're digging before getting a 48-hour location notice or providing an excavation notice, location notice 48 hours ahead of time. So, you know, a lot of moving parts on this. The bottom line is NC3 is in default because they failed to file an answer within 20 days after service of the complaint, and that was the last complaint that we issued on September 25th. So they did not respond to that. Honestly, I don't know why they had responded to the others along the way. They were engaged. They were communicating. But by law, they were required to respond to the complaint. They did not, so they are in default. And as a result of that, the order is for NC3 to be assessed a civil penalty of $1,000 that should be shall be remitted to the North Dakota Public Service Commission within 10 business days of service of this order and notice of default. And I see just a few little typos, but we can get that cleaned up. One would be on should be of, and serve should be service. So apologize for not catching that earlier. But I agree with the fine. And again, just to emphasize, we're not that far from construction season. As always, to excavators and homeowners alike, call before you begin any excavation.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Okay, the next we'll have a few fewer moving parts. I move the commission suspend the tariff and rates, reduce the application fee to $10,000, and issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in Otter Tail Power Company, 2021 LED street and area lighting, dusk to dawn, tariff and rates, case number PU-21-76.
Second.
On February 3rd, 2021, Otter Tail Power Company filed changes to Section 11.01 of its outdoor street and area lighting tariff. Tariffs. Otter Tail Power requests approval of new decorative outdoor lighting options and tariff language clarifying the changes. Otter Tail Power also proposes new lighting rates for primary metered customers. The issues to consider in this proceeding are the proposed tariff revisions just and reasonable? Do the proposed rates comply with the tariff, and are the proposed rates just and reasonable as well? Those interested are invited to comment on the application in writing. Persons desiring a hearing must file a written request identifying their interest in the proceeding and the reasons for requesting a hearing. Comments and requests for hearing must be received by March 22, 2021. If deemed appropriate, the commission can determine the matter without a hearing. And again, our contact number here at the Public Service Commission, telephone number is 701-328-2400. And just a couple of points of clarification on these tariffs, because I was really curious in terms of decorative lighting. And the decorative lighting is essentially variations, but, envision a 14-foot pole. That's one of the descriptions with the globe light on top, something you would find in a downtown area. That's the definition of decorative lighting. It's not for Christmas lights and things like that, to my knowledge. But when I first read it, I thought, decorative lighting, okay. So this would be equipment that the company, I believe the company, and talking to staff, the company would own this equipment. It would be leased out to the cities, so they had to establish base rates and fees for different options, different types of globes, different post heights, etc. But it's something that cities are asking for as they rejuvenate or update downtown areas. So it's an interesting tariff, but something that the company would be coordinating with municipalities on when they apply, should this eventually be approved.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Okay. That concludes my portfolio, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we have a few announcements. Starting in March, we have a couple of significant hearings, some of interest to the public. Most importantly, March 2nd, 3rd, and 4th begins our, 2nd and 4th is our scheduled public input sessions for the MDU gas rate increase. Those are on March 2nd. At noon and 5:30 p.m., and all the information on those is online, but they are, and we just sent out a news release on those, and they will be available for participation virtually. And then on the 4th, we're doing our public input sessions on the NSP electric rate increase proposal. And then in March, on the 18th, we actually have the formal hearing on the MDU gas rate case scheduled for a couple of days, and then later in March a pipeline hearing and a complaint case. So it's going to be a busy month of hearings in March. That pretty much completes all the announcements. We'll now take a brief recess and questions from the press, followed by a short break.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
What dates did you say were the MDU formal hearing?
The MDU formal hearing, the 18th.
I think it starts the 17th.
Oh, whoops. Oh, it did. Yes, I missed that. 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the 17th. Thank you, Randy. stand corrected on that. Okay, meeting, we're now in recess. And we have two members of the press who are here with their physical presence, and maybe we have some online too. So we'd be happy to hear your questions.
Sure.